If reading more books is one of your New Year's resolutions, National Public Radio book critic Maureen Corrigan has a recommendation. She says American Crucible by Vanderbilt History Professor Gary Gerstel is one of the best books for a transformative new year. Gerstel says he chose the title for two reasons.
The term crucible has two meanings. One is a synonym for a melting pot, and my interest in writing this book is how American nationality gets created, who's included, who's excluded, how that changes over time. So American Crucible is meant to refer to the process through which we create ourselves and determine where we draw the lines, which groups are in, which groups are out, how that changes over time. So one of the meanings of American Crucible is of the melting pot through which we create ourselves. And we've always been some kind of a melting pot. It's a question of where the boundaries have been drawn. The other meaning, and probably the more important and longer lasting, is the notion of crucible as an ordeal, as a test. And I would say that the greatest ordeal of our nationhood has been what to do about race and how to address questions of severe racial inequality. If we look over our history and we ask, what has been the biggest problem for us to solve, I would argue more than class, more than gender, it has been race. It has been such a tough problem for this country to deal with. And so in calling this book American Crucible, I'm in some ways referring to the country's greatest ordeal.
You chose the 20th century because that is when so much of the civil rights movement was taking place, and this is the turmoil that perhaps stands out the most.
One could have written a book that goes back to the beginnings of the American Republic, and the racial trouble and the racial inequality we have had is inscribed in the Constitution. It's inscribed in the first nationality and immigration laws that the first Congress passes in 1790. Of course, it's about slavery and its abolition. So one could carry this over the course of all of American history. It's simply an enormous topic, and I felt that for me to do justice to the complexity of the story, I needed to have some temporal boundaries that were briefer than the entire history of the American nation. The 20th century is particularly important to me because it is when the racial nationalist tradition, which I see as one of the principles of our nation, the underlying principles of our nation, it breaks down more irretrievably in the 20th century than in any other moment in our history. So I am drawn to the moment of breakup and crackup and the effort to reconstitute America on a non-racial foundation, which is something that occurs really for the first time after the 1960s.
You talk a lot about two broad ideals, civic nationalism and racial nationalism. What exactly do those terms mean?
Civic nationalism is something we're all familiar with. It's a story we tell about ourselves in America all the time. America is a place where anyone can come, and if they work hard, obey the laws, become an American patriot, they can succeed enormously. It's a land of opportunity. It doesn't matter what your background is or was. It doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter what religion you adhere to. It doesn't matter which part of the world you will have come from. It doesn't matter what privileges you had as a child or how you were impoverished as a child. The promise of America has always been come to America, start over, make for yourself a life here that you could not make somewhere else. And that's a myth, but it's also a reality for millions of Americans or the descendants of millions of people who came here. So civic nationalism refers to that dream. It's about having liberty. It's about having equality. It's about living in a land of democracy where one can both have enormous opportunity for oneself and look forward to participating in this grand republic in which the people rule themselves and live in a society of democratic forms, procedures, and substance. The problem is those people who think that this has been the only tradition around which we have organized ourselves and our nation. Equally potent has been the tradition of racial nationalism, by which I mean the belief that this was a country for certain ethno-racial groups and not for other ethno-racial groups. The most prominent ethno-racial group were people of European descent. It was a belief that Americans were bound together by what we used to call blood. We don't use that word very much anymore, by skin color, and by capacity for self-government that is inherited. In other words, if you really wanted to make self-government work, if you really wanted to make democracy work, the racial nationalist tradition said it'd be pretty good if you were a descendant of someone who was born in England or Scandinavia or Western Europe, because the English peoples of the world and their neighbors in Western Europe, those are the people who really have these attributes for self-government. And so it seeks to root our democratic genius in a belief in the inherent superiority of certain peoples. And so the belief of the racial nationalists is that it's only people of a racially superior type who can really make this experiment in self-government and democracy succeed. And thus America must find in some ways either to exclude those who are not part of this superior group or to subordinate them in some way so that they don't have as much control and say about the country as those who do. The biggest demarcation, of course, is between people of European descent, who we normally call whites, and people of African descent, African Americans, blacks. But one of the aspects of racial nationalism that's so interesting is that at various points in our country's history, various groups who today are unambiguously considered white and part of the white majority in America were at one point in the past considered racially inferior and suspect. And that story starts with the Irish, whose Catholicism and poverty was thought to make them unfit for self-government. It applied to Asian immigrants. It applied to Eastern and Southern Europeans who were Catholics or adherents of one of the Orthodox Christian religions or Jewish. They were thought to be inferior. This principle of racial nationalism, which becomes a principle of exclusion and or subordination, is applied to groups that today we consider to be part of the white majority. But one of the interesting parts about our history is that for substantial parts of that history, they were considered something less than white or less than racially fit to be full participants in the American dream.
What you point out in the book, I notice, is that there are some people that we consider that are liberal and to be more inclusive viewing of people, like Lyndon Johnson. There are certain things that these people do that show, I guess, that they suffer from some of that racial exclusion of people, correct?
One of the central points of the book, and maybe the most important book, is that we can't understand our history if we locate the civic nationalists in one place and the racial nationalists in another. We could do that. We could say, well, the NAACP represents the civic nationalists, and we can say the KKK represents the racial nationalists. What's interesting to me is how often these opposing principles exist in the minds of the same individuals. And these two principles are vying for those individuals' attention. Both have influence on their behavior. And so the book really is focused a lot on liberals who supposedly are the group, one of the groups that is foremost in.
You think that would be viewed as the pro-civil rights.
The pro-civil rights group, and are in the forefront of promoting civic nationalist ideals and do not share illusions about racial superiority and do not want to cast out people for being racially inferior. And perhaps one of the most important points in the book is that many of these liberals themselves harbored inclinations that ran toward racial nationalism. And so even as they are making advances in terms of their liberalism and their commitment to civil rights, they are reinscribing racial nationalist attitudes in their policies and in their attitudes. There is no doubt that Lyndon Johnson, as a white Southerner in the 1960s, having come out of a region deeply beholden to this tradition of racial nationalism, there is no doubt that when he decided to take on civil rights as his own project, that he was taking a great risk, because he knew more than liberals in the North what was at stake. He knew more than liberals in the North how much advances of this sort would be resisted. He anticipated that the Democratic Party as a force in national elections would suffer terribly from this, because he expected the Democratic South to leave the Democratic Party and become the Republican South. And he anticipated this in 1964 and 65, and he was absolutely right. So I see him and I admire him as a champion of civil rights and having the best instincts and having the best ambitions for the country. But even he, in the course of trying to promote civil rights legislation, in the course of trying to get himself reelected, ended up reinscribing notions about the superiority of whites and the inferiority of blacks. And the example I use in my book, which to me was very vivid, is at the 1964 Democratic Party convention, and where he has been nominated, and he is the party's choice. And Goldwater is weak, and he expects it to be a coronation. And there appears at this convention an alternate delegation from Mississippi. They call themselves the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And it's a black and white organization, but they have said there is no place for us in the regular Democratic Party organization in the state of Mississippi because blacks, by and large, cannot vote. We are the duly constituted representatives from this state, and we want to be seated as the official delegation. And Johnson cannot tolerate their interference with his coronation, and he undertakes various steps to make sure that they are marginalized. And also in the process manages to insult them by saying things like, don't we know what we are doing for them? Don't they know what is at stake here? Don't they know when push comes to shove, this country has to put its faith in its white leaders, and blacks really need to be a bit patient and stand on the sidelines? I analyze his words along those lines, most of them spoken in private. And what I see in those kinds of words is really an effort, not an effort, but an admission that he really thought blacks were not quite ready for full equality in America, that they really needed to accept the tutelage of whites to get them to where they needed to be. And in such ways, he was admitting that he still subscribed to the notion that blacks were not quite as good as whites and that it was really best for them to leave it to whites to show them the way toward equality. So he wanted equality, but when he was confronted with a group of black citizens from the South who were demanding equality now and demanding that their representation not be put off for another election or another time after all the hardships they had suffered, he said, you're going to have to wait because we know what's best for you. So in those kinds of actions, I find that even those people who consider themselves to be liberals carry within them prejudices about the abilities and qualities of blacks, when, and especially in situations of stress, come out and shape the policies they're writing and the comments that they make.
You also mention a lot in your book about the Rooseveltian nation. Are you referring to Teddy Roosevelt?
I'm referring to Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt. I see, until the 1970s, the most important political ideology in America was liberalism. It wasn't called liberalism at first. It was first called progressivism. It's named liberalism in the 1930s. And the two most important architects of that are Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt. And I say this about Theodore Roosevelt knowing full well that he was a member of the Republican Party and not the Democratic Party, but he was also a founder of the Progressive Party when they withdrew from the Republican Party in the election of 1912. And the manifesto or the political platform of the Progressive Party in 1912 really anticipates just about everything in liberal reform for the next 50 years. So it's a term that I use to describe the liberal nation. By that I mean a nation that liberals were trying to create. Its two most important architects are first Theodore Roosevelt and then Franklin Roosevelt. You might ask, why don't I use liberal? I didn't want to use liberal because people think they know what liberal means. And it wasn't, of course, simply a liberal nation that they were trying to create, although they were trying to do that. They were also carrying forward this tradition of racial nationalism, the notion that whites or people of European descent or what Theodore Roosevelt used to call the English-speaking peoples of the world were superior to others. So my point of using the Rooseveltian nation is to defamiliarize people with something that they think they know and to open their minds to get them to think about another strain of this nation. It's not to diminish the importance of the liberalism, but it's also to insist that this liberal nation that the Roosevelts were creating and that many, many Americans wanted to create with them were also carrying forward this tradition of racial nationalism, this conviction that some Americans were better than others by virtue of their color, their race, their blood, and that America would be a nation for them first and a nation for those who fell outside the definition of the racially superior. It would be their nation only secondarily.
John McCain talked a lot about Teddy Roosevelt as being someone he admired. Do you think there were any aspects of that, or was that more tied to the fact that his feistiness or some other personality trait?
I think John McCain probably doesn't know much about the racial attitudes of Theodore Roosevelt. When I wrote the story and when I've spoken about the book and I tell the story of the Rough Riders on San Juan Hill, most people, they know about the Rough Riders. They know about Theodore Roosevelt. They know nothing about the centrality of the black soldiers to Roosevelt's success on San Juan Hill, and then the systematic way in which he goes about expunging their contributions to the battle from the historical record. So I think McCain knows a lot less about Roosevelt's racial nationalism than he should, but most people don't know much about it. We have, in a sense, sanitized him in that way. Another part of Roosevelt's inheritance, I think, and ideas is something that McCain is very much in touch with, and that is precisely the liberalism that I've been talking about. It's a different kind of republicanism. It comes out of a different Republican Party than the one that exists today. And it was McCain's effort to say there is a role for government in the economy. There is a role for government in managing capitalism, that the market cannot do everything by itself. And McCain knows that part of Roosevelt's thinking very well. One of the reasons why Roosevelt was insisting on government regulation was that he said we must put the interests of the Commonwealth ahead of the interests of private individuals and private property. And there's a strong instinct in McCain that says the same thing. So he understood that part of Roosevelt very well. I admire him for knowing that part of Roosevelt. My chagrin and dismay with McCain is that during the course of his campaign, first for the Republican nomination and then in the general election, he really stopped talking about Roosevelt because he can no longer talk about that republicanism. In order to be the nominee of the Republican Party, he had to embrace completely the free market ideology which governs the modern Republican Party, and he had to please the base. So I think he understood the government philosophy and the management of the economy philosophy of Theodore Roosevelt extremely well. I admire him for knowing that, and I was dismayed to see he abandoned that, which I think he believes very deeply, for the sake of securing the Republican nomination and pleasing the Republican base.
So what does your book say with regards to our new administration? What is the significance of this book, do you think?
The first thing I would say is my book helps to appreciate the magnitude of this moment. Part of the message of my book is that racism was continually being reinscribed into American life, even when we thought we had gotten beyond it. So in the 20s, which we think of as being a free and easy jazz age, we passed these very harsh and very racist immigration laws, excluding people on the basis of their alleged race alone. In World War II, when we were fighting this great war for democracy, we fought it with a segregated military and by and large did not allow blacks to fight. There can be no black soldiers in Steven Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan because none were allowed to land on the Normandy beaches in the 1960s. They were kept out of combat and entirely in the rear, the quartermaster corps, as though the army was reproducing the old southern plantation. These attitudes survive again into the 1960s. And so for anyone reading my book, it's a sobering account of how sturdy and how resilient this tradition of racial nationalism has been and how it's been able to reinvent itself across every century and across every generation. So for us to be in a position where we have elected an African-American president of the United States is an extraordinary achievement, and one that as recently as 20 years ago would have seemed incomprehensible and something that would not happen. I never thought that I would see this in my lifetime. And I think you see the most powerful residue of this tradition of racial nationalism in America's oldest voters because they are the products of these earlier racial nationalists' eras, and nothing in their experience prepared them for this, and many of them can simply not bring themselves to vote for an African American. So the first point I would stress is the magnitude of this moment, the magnitude of this achievement in American history. The second point I would make is the importance of the 1960s in making the continuation of racial nationalism impossible. If we point to a time in American history when politicians could no longer say frankly racist things in public without paying a price, It's not the Civil War. It's not World War I. It was not the War for Democracy in World War II. It was not the Civil Rights Movement of the 50s. It was the 60s, and it was at that moment that mostly through popular insurgency of African Americans and their allies taking to the streets, mostly nonviolently, an extraordinarily courageous and effective protest, developing lots of allies, saying this situation cannot continue in America anymore. It's really a fulfillment of Martin Luther King's dream, the dream that we can be a nation of many peoples and many colors without racism. But it takes terrible strife and terrible battles and violence in the 60s to disrupt and upend a racial nationalist tradition that had been so incredibly powerful. For a long time after the 1960s, it was not clear whether we would get beyond the recriminations of that era. I remember the early 1990s, the O.J. Simpson trial, and the verdict in that trial, and the conviction that most Americans had coming out of that, that we are two nations and that we can never come together. This was a legacy, profound distrust that came out of the 1960s. Many of us believe that the O.J. Simpson trial and the L.A. riots and the very acrimonious atmosphere that prevailed between blacks and whites in the 80s and 90s would prevail forever and mark the resuscitation of the racial nationalist tradition. In fact, we now know that this very difficult period from the 1960s until the last few years was a very difficult and positive working through by this country of its racial heritage, its racial sins, and an incredible determination by a tremendous number of people to find a way to a more egalitarian future. I think we can now say that a process that began in the 60s has yielded a huge dividend. My final point is that if we think that we're done with racial problems in this country, we're deluding ourselves. We're going to have a long honeymoon with Obama, but there's some very serious racial problems that remain and that they will reappear. My hope is, however, that with this election, we have gotten to a new point and can finally begin to glimpse a post-racial future for a nation that whose entire history has been immersed in race consciousness and race prejudice. That's my hope.
What are some of the things you think might change under Obama?
I think Obama points the way to a post-racial future.
And what does that mean exactly? I've heard that term a lot.
I think it means that we are not necessarily defined by our race. If you choose to be defined by your race, that's fine. If a group of African Americans wants to celebrate their black heritage, if a group of immigrants wants to study and wants to celebrate their heritage, that's fine and appropriate. But for those people who wish not to be bound by that, perhaps they will begin to have the freedom to do so. It may come out in other ways, too. One of the racist acts in this country was the definition of who was black. And it came to mean that anyone in the late 19th century, and one of the nadirs of our race relations, it came to mean that anyone with one drop of black blood was black. Well, why exactly should someone with 1% of black blood and, let's say, 99% of white blood, why should they have to be black? Why shouldn't they have the opportunity to become white or multicultural? In fact, we now have a growing population of people in America who are multiracial and who are not comfortable identifying or being identified solely as one race or another. They should have the freedom to declare themselves to be multiracial or to declare that their race is simply not important to them at all. So a post-racial future means not that people won't assemble in racial or ethnic groups and celebrate the heritage that is distinct to them, but it means they will have the freedom not to do that if they so wish. If we ever get to that point, it will be a very major achievement for this country. So I think Obama – that's not going to happen for a long time yet, but Obama's election opens up the possibility of that. We cannot forget that Obama, quite apart from race, is a Democrat and a liberal – and not a Republican or a conservative. And his first matter of business for the first couple of years is going to be the economy and rescuing us all from a huge mess that we've gotten into. And we're going to see the old liberalism come back in important ways. And by that, I mean the conviction that the power the government has to be used to regulate and stabilize a free market that has wreaked enormous havoc on an enormous number of lives. I also would like to think that we can get to, with Obama, what we might call a third reconstruction, which will probably be necessary before we get to this post-racial future that I was just telling you about. Reconstruction is a term that refers to major efforts by this country to correct the racial wrongs. The first reconstruction happened after the Civil War and involved emancipation and the passage of the 14th Amendment and the putting the freedmen and women in a position to live independent lives. The second reconstruction was what happened in the 1960s with the Civil Rights Revolution, and that's made enormous difference in terms of helping many African Americans participate more fully and more equally in American life than has ever been the case in our history. But it's also true that the second reconstruction has been much more successful with middle-class African Americans than with poor African Americans, and it remains the case that the problems of African Americans in poverty, African Americans in incarceration, African Americans in isolation from many currents in American life, it remains the case that those problems are very intense and very much with us. And it is my belief that we're probably going to need a third reconstruction before we can reach this post-racial future that I'm hoping we will reach. And I'm hoping that the Obama administration can point us in the right direction in that way. We're not going to see any race-conscious policies for some time because Obama has been, throughout his campaign, run as a candidate for all Americans. And one can be sure that his first year or two are going to be emphatically focused on that campaign promise and pledge. But once, you know, if there's success in that area, one can begin to think of perhaps a third reconstruction that focuses on the problems that the Civil Rights Revolution raised but has not been able to solve.
Gary Gerstle is the James G. Stallman Professor of American History at Vanderbilt University. His book, American Crucible, Race and Nation in the 20th Century, is published by Princeton University Press.